A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rehm, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on March 3, 2004, a midweek Lenten service, entitled About Religion, in the series What I Choose to Believe. The texts for the sermon are Isaiah 44, verses 9 through 20, and Acts 17, verses 16 through 31. Copyright Grand Valley State University. Please note that the original recording spanned two sides of a cassette tape, so there was some missing material. I will bridge the gap.
For these Lenten midweek services, I have chosen to set the theme as I choose to believe, what I choose to believe about various subjects. And that theme is the consequence of my intention of saying to you that I'm going to be telling you things that I believe, things that you don't necessarily believe or have to believe, but there's some things that I want to say about the various subjects, religion, Christian faith, the Bible, the tradition, etc., the church. Some things that I choose to believe about those particular subjects. And in setting the theme that way, I am intentionally setting forth a model of epistemological modesty. You understand what epistemological modesty is, don't you? Epistemology is the study of how we know. How do we know what we know? I was going through a catalog this week, and religious books, you know, all those things that start out at $49.95 and end up $6.95, and there was one that deserved that kind of reduction in price. Just from the title, I could tell that. It was What God Knows and When God Knows It. Now that would not be exactly epistemological modesty. Isn't that humorous, really? There's really a book like that. What God Knows and When God Knows It. That's quite amazing. Well, I choose to take another tact and to tell you quite honestly that the things I'm going to tell you are the things that I believe, that I choose to believe, without any claim that they are a statement of absolute truth, or even the final place at which I will find myself, I who have been on this spiritual journey for all my life, I guess, huh? And what I am trying to say by setting the theme in that manner, I'm trying to say to you that in all of these things about which we will be thinking together in our reflections in these midweek services are things that defy absolute statement of truth, that they are not matters of facticity, verifiable claims, but rather they are matters of the heart, and they are matters ultimately of trust, and therefore they are matters about which one must have a bit of humility and modesty in the affirmation and the declaration of what one believes, even though one can be convinced and ought to be convinced in one's heart that what one believes is true. And yet we have to say once again, it is true as I understand it. It is again one of those questions of authority. And so what I am modeling out before you and what I talk about in these various subjects is a kind of a claim for my own authority, with the encouragement that you likewise recognize the need for an authority within yourself, that there is not an external authority that is impressed upon us, but that actually, fundamentally, finally, whether we are aware of it or not, or whether we would admit it or not, I think we do live out of our own authority, those things that resonate within the depths of our being. We may claim a lot of things that we don't really believe, but our life will always tell it. And I'm simply trying to be honest with you this evening and in these weeks, because once again, I want to be clear before I go. And one of the things that has been very important in our spiritual experience together is that movement from the claims of absoluteness to the more modest acknowledgement of the tentativeness and the provisionalness and the humanness and the historically conditionedness of the things that we believe together. And so in so stating the theme, I have already said a great deal about my first subject, which is religion. I'm not going to say anything new to you tonight, anything that I haven't said before, but I do want to say it one more time. And the most radical statement that I can make is that religion is a human imaginative construct. And in saying that, I am saying that religions don't fall out of heaven ready-made. And the religion that we, the religious faith and vision that we share together, is not synonymous with some absolute vision that God has given, but is rather a human, imaginative, creative construct. It is a product of human thinking and experiencing and feeling and intuiting. It is, finally, a human product. Religion is not divine, it is human. That's a very radical claim. You don't hear it in church very often because it doesn't make for strong institutions. If everybody throughout all the centuries would believe as I believed about these things, we wouldn't have any story of Jesus Christ or a Christian church down through 2,000 years. You understand that. It takes people who do believe it was concocted in heaven and came here ready hatched, and that God said, and it is thus and so. It is such people that create institutions that perpetuate stories. I'm aware of that. But I can't help it. I can't be one of them. I will never in my life, I have not built a strong institution. The only thing I'm going to be good for is what I'm ending up with. The little band of pilgrims. A little independent liberal community of people who get along well and like each other and love life. That's about as much as you can do if you believe the nature of religion as I do. It doesn't make for strong institutions. I picked up Elaine Pagel's book again, Beyond Belief, in which she talks about the church father Irenaeus, who was one of the highly respected church fathers. And he was a bishop, I think it was in the 2nd century. A devout leader of the church, and who himself had had visions and revelations. But when he came to the area of Gaul, now we call France, there was chaos all around because everybody was having a vision and a revelation, and you can't form a tight-knit community and build an institution when everybody's going off in their own direction, everybody's claiming that they've had this vision. And so Irenaeus works very, very hard to create an orthodox statement of Christian faith, to draw the line, and to say, this is correct opinion. That's what orthodox means, correct opinion. And if you believe this, you are saved. And if you do not believe this, you are wrong, you are in error, and you are lost. And as I read that again, some of the things that Irenaeus said, I realized that from the beginning, there has been this tendency to say, I am right and you are wrong. To draw a line. To claim an absolute. To give little room for deviation, for nuance. That's been the nature of institutional religion. So we write creeds. We make confessional statements. And we write formulas of subscription. So that if I'm going to be ordained in a particular denomination, I sign my name to these things that I will uphold or I will say or whatever. That's the very nature of institutional life. I'm not condemning it. I acknowledge its necessity. But what it does do is create the impression that religion is about that which is definable and verifiable. And it almost always becomes absolute. And of course, to be honest, most people love to have it so, because there is also in the human heart a lust for certitude. You would really want me to give you something with I's dotted and T's crossed. Be honest now. It is easier that way. And if you trust me, and you can trust that, and you can scratch that one off and get on with your life. What do we believe? Well, it's difficult here to say what we believe, because there's no party line. And even the preacher isn't always certain. And so what's a poor pilgrim to do? You have to think for yourself. I don't know why I still get... I still get the Church Herald from the Reformed Church, and this past week, did I mention this on Sunday? I told somebody about it. I don't usually read the articles, but I read the letters to the editor. It's a wonderful reacquaintance with average religion, and they have a preacher who has an answer question and answer thing, a column where he answers questions that are written in. And someone had written in a question about does God save people who are not Christians? And this poor preacher, I could have tipped him off ahead of time. I could have saved him a lot of grief. But in that little column that's not even one whole page in the Church Herald, he got 7 letters. And, for example, regarding the question of faith, does God save people who are not Christians? Jack Cherry writes, I don't know if God will save non-Christians, nor does anyone else. That was his answer. Bad mistake. Well, this letter writer, this young lady from Jenison, or maybe she's an older woman, I don't know. Well, I believe I do know. John 14:6 states that no one comes to the Father except through me. I think that says it all. Next letter. I think this couple's from my home church in Kalamazoo. We are very concerned and saddened about the seemingly humanistic view of some persons in the RCA about the issue of who Jesus is and the beautiful promises of salvation found in Scripture. We would encourage the people of God to know and study the Word. It tells us very clearly that only through Jesus Christ can persons be saved. And then this one says, the Bible says, don't judge that you be not judged, but then goes on to say there's something more important than that, and that's the truth. And then this one, to allow the possibility for salvation of those outside of Christ sounds pious. God is all-powerful and loving, after all, and our understanding of who God is and who He saves is subject to the mystery of God. Well, that's good. But since God has told us in His Word that there is no such possibility, John 14:6, Acts 4:12, 1 Timothy 2:5, continuing to assert such a possibility turns into an outright contradiction of God. Well, they really get better, but I better quit with that. But when I read that, it reminds me of where I came from, see? Because I would have written that letter 100 years ago myself. But my point is, that question of who is saved or how one is saved, that elicits such anxiety in people who have been given a very clear formula, who believe that it is by saying this or believing this that they are saved and their eternal salvation. And as a matter of fact, I think if they really understood themselves, what they are manifesting is a deep anxiety. They're not really confident and sure and relaxed, resting in the grace of God, but they have to have this particular formulation. And I do with a little bit of humor tonight, but as a matter of fact, that is not a comfortable way to live. And so, if I have taken away your easy answers, and if I have robbed you of the security of a pastor who says, "Thus saith the Lord," I have also opened up the possibility of you moving beyond a kind of fragile faith that needs certain formulae in order to feel secure. So, what I'm saying to you about religion tonight, that it is a human, imaginative, creative construct, doesn't build strong institutions, and it doesn't satisfy that very natural, normal human lust for certitude. But I think that it does open up the possibility of something far better. And that is coming to recognize religion for what it is. And what is it? I believe it is openness to that quest and that longing and that yearning within us to live fully and richly a human existence. It is that pursuit of meaning that will enable us to live with awareness and with attention and with wonder and with reverence and with gratitude. and with joy. Where did it come from? Well, it's been here forever. It's a universal human phenomenon. Because we human beings are the consciousness of the universe. And in our coming to consciousness, we face this ultimate mystery. And it's a scary thing to be human. We're vulnerable to nature. And before there was any scientific understanding of nature about us, there were stories told that were attempts at explanation. And religion offered the possibility, ways of reconciliation and an appeasement of these ultimate forces, or the ultimate force. Religion has been, historically, the means by which human beings have come to terms with the vulnerability of their human existence. A way to find comfort. A way to find security. A way to build community, beginning in the clans and tribally. This is where it originated. It's a very natural and normal human manifestation of the recognition by self-conscious creatures of the mystery of existence and ultimately the fact that we die. That's where it comes from. And so what is it? Well, it's living by a story or a vision. Someone has an epiphany, tells the story. It resonates with a community. And in light of that vision or that understanding, rituals are developed, ways by which one can be in relationship with that ultimate mystery. And in light of that vision and that understanding, which finds expression in worship forms and structures, there's also a way of life that issues. So it's a story, and it's a way of worship, and it's a way of life. If you want to read about that, my old professor Hendrikus Berkhoff has a nice section on that in his Christian Faith. Sometime years ago, I mentioned that in a sermon, and Marcus Borg always liked to get sermon tapes, and I sent him a tape with that in it, and he emailed me to say, where did that come from? I'd like to use that sometime, and I'd give credit if you've got it somewhere. Well, I keep checking his books, but I don't get a footnote anywhere. But it's very simple, isn't it? A vision. Moses at the burning bush. Jesus at his baptism. Buddha. Whatever. An epiphany. And I'm not saying that's simply a human generation. I'm saying that is a human experience of that which is ultimate and mysterious. And then out of that flows a way of devotion and a way of life. And when it's good religion, it enhances our humanity and elicits from us nobility of spirit, and builds communities of care and compassion. A couple weeks ago, someone came in at the end of the 8:30 service in which I had made a statement. And then they stayed for the 10 o'clock service, but I never made that statement at the end. So he came up to me and he said, at the tail end of the 8:30 service, you said thus and so, and you never said that at the 10 o'clock service. I said, you're quite right. I said, that ruins the whole sermon, actually, because it was the best statement I had to make that day. And it was a quote from Christer Stendahl, that wonderful bishop, New Testament scholar. Remember when he was here? Religion, good religion opens the mind and softens the heart. Bad religion closes the mind and hardens the heart. Now think about that in light of today's world.
Think about that in the light of the role of religion in the explosive, volatile world situation through which we're living.
Good religion doesn't have to claim it's absolute or it's the one and only. Jesus said, by their fruit ye shall know them. And that's not a bad test for good religion. Good religion will open the mind. It will allow us to soar with all of the human disciplines of knowledge, and we won't have to fear the next stone that's turned in case it contradicts something in some absolute statement of the truth or some biblical statement. It opens the mind. It invites the journey and the exploration of this marvelous cosmic phenomenon of which we're a part. And it softens the heart. It enables us to accept one another in our fallibility, in our flawedness, in our quirks and idiosyncrasies. We can accept each other, warts and all, because we all have them. And we can accept ourselves, too, as human beings on the way. Good religion is humanizing. And it creates communities for encouragement and for support and for compassion and for care. Good religion. Religion practiced with that kind of posture enables us to continue to grow and to relax and to live in light of the wonder and the miracle and the glory and the joy of life. I don't think religion is about some formula by which I can be eternally saved for another age. I think good religion is about enabling me to be the very best human being I can be right here and now. And to wring all of the juice out of life and to suck all of the marrow out of life. Somebody gave me a little saying which I can't quote exactly, but it was something to the effect that the purpose of life is not to come to the end of one's life with a well-preserved body in perfect shape, but to come sliding broadside into home base, scratched and torn, but with the cry, wow, what a ride. That's the way to live. And that's the way to die. And good religion will inspire. One final word. Good religion also opens us to the aesthetic dimension of life. To be in a setting like this, beautifully appointed, with wonderful music that reaches beyond or through and beneath the rational mind and touches the soul, that lifts and enhances and makes beautiful this human journey. Well, that's what I think about religion.